Joe, why don't you hitch up the team?
Man, I've been fighting this stump off and on for 2 years. It's a team now, this stump could say it beat us. Sometimes there ain't nothing it'll do but your own sweat and muscle.
Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
And I'm Matt. I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 until 2015, starting with number one and working down.
Here's how this works. The two of us have gone through each list, decided on a theme of the original entry, and have come up with a pair of potential replacement titles which share that theme. We'll talk about that original entry. Sometimes we'll regret that we have to get rid of it, and sometimes we'll rejoice in being able to drop it. But this podcast is not just another dissection of an outmoded list. In part one of this episode, Matt had two new albums to talk through, and I made my choice for the Subtitles album list. Now in part two, I have two new movies to discuss, and Matt will decide which of them deserves a place on the Subtitles movie list. Sometimes I'll have listened to the albums, sometimes he'll have seen the movies, but at the end of the day, what matters is how well we've sold the titles. And at the end of some of those days, one of us will want to bop the other for that choice. Once we finish these lists off, we'll do some fun activities with these new lists we've collaborated on. But before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title to be replaced is Shane from 1953. This is George Stevens' Western, which is one of those foundational Westerns. It's one of those Westerns that you sort of, if you don't grow up on them exactly, it's one of the Westerns that they keep referencing and coming back to. So like there's this period from like 1939 to 1969, which is basically Stagecoach to the Wild Bunch, and Shane is smack dab in the middle of that. And one of the things that's interesting about Shane is that it is kind of a rarity among that group, in that most of the Westerns that you see tend to be made by devoted makers of Westerns, which is not to say that there aren't some exceptions in there. In fact, we've talked about two already that I think are better than this movie in The Oxbow Incident, which is a William A. Wellman, who is not known for his Westerns, and Nicholas Ray's Johnny Guitar, which was in our first episode and which is by a director who's really not known for his Westerns. But George Stevens, someone who, as we've talked about before, is someone who starts off his career in the 30s and is making musicals. We looked at him with Swing Time already as we sort of went down this list, which is the only Astaire Rogers collaboration on the AFI 2007 list. And then here we are, what, like 50 spots later or something like that, and we're to his second and final movie on the list. It is perhaps worth noting that George Stevens is the father of George Stevens Jr., which seems like that should come with a spoiler alert. Apologies to those of you who may have been uncomfortable with that. But George Stevens Jr., do you remember what this guy is famous for? We haven't talked about it in an extremely long time, but we have mentioned who George Stevens Jr. is on this podcast before.
I don't remember at all, so this is going to be fun for me, too.
He has been on the board of the American Film Institute since the beginning. The AFI Lifetime Achievement Award was done by George Stevens Jr. I don't think it's a coincidence that George Stevens has had movies on each of these lists, even as the popularity of George Stevens has decreased, because George Stevens Jr., continues to be alive and continues to be involved with the AFI. So if you're looking at this and thinking, really, Shane is the fourth best American Western of all time, well, I don't know how much influence George Stevens Jr. has on getting his dad's work on there, but it probably isn't nothing. So that's your fun nepotism, or what is it called when you're doing stuff for your parents' benefit? Is there a term for that?
That's what I was trying to figure out. I don't know that there is. I think it's still just nepotism. I was just going to call it upside down nepotism.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I like upside down nepotism. That makes it sound like a Candyland card. There's something about Shane that I think people look at it and think it is kind of a square movie. It's a 50s Western. Most 50s Westerns are going to get that sort of "this is for squares" kind of mentality, just because we think the 50s were for squares, even though even a tenuous grasp of the understanding of the 1950s would say otherwise. But Shane is a movie which is, you know, it's a very much like a white hat, black hat Western, down to the fact that Shane, played by Alan Ladd, is wearing a white hat, and Jack Palance, who is playing the bad guy in this, is wearing a black hat. So, like, it is definitely one of those. It is definitely a movie where all of the symbolism is pretty blunt. It's a movie where good triumphs over evil. I guess really spoilers for this movie from almost literally 70 years ago, but Shane is a film where Shane wins and the bad guys lose. Go Shane. And I think it's very easy to dismiss it as this kind of, again, kind of square, kind of vanilla Western, especially because it's so respected and because it's referenced. Again, Stevens is not a guy who we think of as making Westerns, but he probably has made the second most referenced Western by a non-Western director. And first place, I would say, is High Noon. So we're talking about a movie like High Noon Company. The only other Westerns above it on the AFI list are High Noon and Treasure of the Sierra Madre and The Searchers. So, like, this is rarefied air. And when I went back to rewatch it, because this is one of those movies that I hadn't seen until a few years ago, when I was trying to actually like get into movies and try to clear up some of the obvious holes in my viewing. I knew about Shane Come Back in the squeaky Brandon DeWild voice, which I will not profane this new microphone with an impression of, because I want it to work later, soon even. And it's a movie which does have like a nice cast of characters between Ladd and Palance and Brandon DeWild. It's also got Van Heflin and Gene Arthur as this couple living in Wyoming. There's a very Johnson County War vibe to this. Again, I feel like all I'm doing is self-referencing, but we talked about the Johnson County War with Heaven's Gate, which is like a better version of this. But even so, Shane is a movie which has all of these very obvious pieces. And yet when you watch it, like when you actually go back and watch it, and the first time I was like fine with it, but this time I was really taken with it, with how dark it was, which is not a word that I expected to think of when I watched it. Part of it is just that this is a movie which starts with a gunslinger coming to town. This is really like your number one gunslinger comes to town movie. He shows up by himself and kind of has to prove his worth just to get accepted by this frontier family, the Starrets. And then he sticks around, becomes part of the family, becomes sort of a beloved figure for Joey, who is the wild character's name. And he like is part and parcel of this little community. And as the film goes on, you realize a few things. You realize the sheer brutality of the people in the employ of the ranchers who are trying to drive out these small farmers in Wyoming. There is a very, very beautiful scene. Like, it's an incredible seen from like a from a cinematography perspective. There's these wonderful wide angle shots. There's this really interesting dolly movement across a muddy street. And at the end of it, Jack Palance just absolutely blows away Elisha Cook Jr., who is trying to stand up to him, who is trying to talk tough. And Palance just like goads him into picking up his gun and then shoots him, and he gets yanked backwards and he like slides through the mud. It's a dark scene, and it's not the first like dark scene that we've had in here. There are a number of fist fights that like there are ways to do fist fights in kind of funny, goofy ways, but these don't feel funny or goofy. These feel like two people who really want to beat the crap out of each other. You also have the fact that Joe, the Van Heflin character, is kind of this sad sack person, who is holding together this group of small farmers, and he's not an especially strong man, but he's at least stronger than some of these other guys, which is not really a vote of confidence for him. At the end of the movie, when it's clear that there's going to be one final showdown, both Joe and Shane decide that they're the man who has to go do it. So in order to do it, instead of like teaming up or something, they have another fist fight. There is yet another punching scene, and Shane has to beat his benefactor into a pulp, like basically beat him unconscious, which is like not a good omen. Like, it's not a good feeling before you go in to do like a clearing out of the saloon, sort of like what you see at the end of Unforgiven. And I mean, Unforgiven feels like such an obvious homage to this. Have I mentioned that Joe's wife and Shane have a history? Like, have we talked about how those two definitely were doing it in the past, and everyone can kind of tell? Down, of course, to the child, down to Joey himself, who, as Shane rides off into the distance, Joey shouts after him that Pa's got things for you to do, and very, very intently, Mother wants you, I know she does, which is one of the great vague lines in movie history. It's a movie that's got a lot going on, and I mean, even if you start taking it outside itself and looking for metaphors elsewhere, like, this is almost as much of a Blacklist movie as High Noon. High Noon is a very obvious Blacklist allegory, and Rio Bravo, which was made some years later, is a very obvious anti-Blacklist allegory. But there's some of that in Shane too, like that same idea of the gunfighter against larger, shadier powers than himself. I mean, it's the same idea. It's only a year after High Noon. And Steven's politics kind of suit that anyway. It's definitely a movie which is responding to that. So this is my pitch for Shane. A movie that I definitely appreciated a lot more on the second viewing, and a movie that is, again, if you want to find a square Western, they exist, but this really isn't one of them. There's a lot going on here.
That model of like the lone gunslinger fighting shady forces is just everything, not just Westerns. And it does. So I've not actually seen all of Shane ever. I've seen parts of it, and like, it's just embedded in kind of cultural consciousness. And I suppose that's a question I have for you, but I'll get to that in a second. But like, that's sort of what it is to me, where it is like, right, it is kind of the trope that a lot of things are. And I know other stuff did that before it. But like, culturally to me, that seems to be the place that it occupies. But yeah, I guess my question for you, like, again, I've never seen this fully somehow. Is this one that I know this is one that people are familiar with? Is this one people have seen? Like, do you have a sense of that?
So when I was like going through for another post like a month ago, sort of looking at which movies I thought would rise or fall on the AFI list. This is one that I think is probably, again, if George Stevens Jr. is alive, all bets are off. But if he's still kicking and still has any amount of influence on this, I would be shocked to see Shane drop. But it's not a movie that I think has held its reputation that much, even from 2007 to now, let alone like 97 to now or 98. I'm pretty sure this actually rose between the lists, but I would just be really surprised if this were one that people went back to, just because I do think that it does have that sort of very basic vibe to it, because it is so fundamental, like you were sort of saying about the gunslinger thing. Like there's a gunslinger for every genre, but there is no genre where the gunslinger matters quite as much as this one. And this one is so like axiomatic to every other gunslinger movie that anyone will ever make, that I think it's kind of easy to lose sight of the influence and again, like the power that it genuinely does have, which for better or worse, I don't know if it's the kind of thing that people talk about as much anymore, just because it is, we talk about revisionist Westerns all the time, and I hate the term, and we've talked about it, but this is not a revisionist Western. Like, this one is definitely not like that. And I do think that people just would rather get into things that feel revisionist or prestige-y, rather than the originals, which basically just do the thing really well head on.
I mean, you need an original to have a revisionist, and this seems like we'll do all the, as you were saying, basic stuff, and then people can play with that later, but I don't know, the model holds up. Like, even if your thing is revision, like, the model inherently holds up in that. So, to me, like, just my general perception anyway, like, that's sort of where Shane exists. And I don't, like, honestly, I guess I was surprised it was here on the list. But I also don't have a great sense of it as a movie, obviously. So, I don't know, it seems like totally predictable from the AFI and surprising at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a good way to put it, is that I'm sort of surprised it's made it here. And in fact, it rose like almost 25 spots. Like it did not just make it here, but like jumped. It's one of the big risers from the original list. So I don't know if that says that in AFI world people were super excited about bringing it on for another go round. Something that I do think is really interesting about it is this idea it has, where it is just fundamentally uncomfortable with violence, and it's not comfortable with having to use violence at all. So like, we don't really know what Shane has been up to, and I make this joke all the time, but like, if this were an 8-episode miniseries or limited series, I guess we call them now, if this were an 8-episode limited series somewhere, the first 2 episodes would be Shane's adventures beforehand, in which he turned into a dark, gritty person with all of these bodies in his past instead of just showing up, and we know he's got trouble. But there's something about the movie where every time someone has to use violence at all, and it's especially Shane, because he's the one who is the most successful at using violence. He has to use it, and he hates doing it. He puts it off as long as he can. He gets himself beaten up pretty badly one time because he just refuses to really get into the brawl with another person, with all of himself. Eventually it works, but like, he is someone who doesn't want to pick up the gun again, someone who can see the gun as a tool but doesn't see it as a tool that he wants to use anymore. And what makes that last scene so special is, like, at this point he's killed a whole bunch of people after presumably telling himself that he wouldn't kill anyone again, and there's just like this sense, well, I'm already so broken, I'm already so damned that, like, it doesn't matter if I rack up these bodies or not. Like, I know that for myself, I'd rather not do it. But as a practical matter, it's better for me to, like, be a sort of Christ figure who can take on the sins for these other small farmers who don't deserve to have that put on them. Like, there's a lot of genuine hard feeling here that I find really, really interesting. Not just the idea of, like, someone who doesn't want to use violence, but it also is so clear that if the farmers are going to survive where they are, they're going to need violence. And the movie is uncomfortable with that too. Like, it does not like that Shane has to be there any more than Shane does, if that makes sense. Like, it's a movie which is very uncomfortable with this idea that sometimes the only way to overcome violent people is to be better at violence than them. And that's something which, I mean, when you start thinking about it, you start, like, you have to really go into some dark places, I think, to get around that idea. And it's not a pleasant concept to think about, but that's really what this movie boils down to in the last 20, 30 minutes, which are really exceptional.
You say that, and I think of Oklahoma as well, mm-hmm. as, like, another narrative potentially uncomfortable with its own violence, though I'm not sure if it's Mustard Shane. Right, both of those is, it will, you know, Western frontier stories, we'll say. And that is sort of the abiding, like, American myth, or, like, that, like, that is the unique form of Americana. And I don't know, it just makes me wonder how much both are, like, especially in this, like, you know, not long from World War II moment, like, how they're wrestling with the violence inherent to this kind of national mission or national understanding. And, like, this Western frontier space is the representation of that. Or, you know, do they kind of land on, well, our violence is better. Like, we had to do it. And, this, like, right, to protect the farmers, kind of that idea of the violence we met was better in some way. Seems like Shane is much more generally uncomfortable with that than, like, Oklahoma is, but I just, like, that's a curious, I don't know, kind of thing to me, and I think it makes, you know, perfect sense in the 50s especially.
Yeah, and that's like the tail end. I love the Oklahoma thing, obviously, but, like, Oklahoma, like, ends so uncomfortably and so strangely, and, like, that show is, like, I've always thought it was the strangest thing that at the end Curly has to kill, and that Judd, who, like, very obviously to us now, I don't know how it was in 1943 when it first premiered, but, like, Judd is someone who very obviously does not deserve the death that he's facing, because, like I think every version of Oklahoma since the, you know, the 50s one, which is very similar in timing to this, has sort of, like, looked at Judd as a more sympathetic figure, which is why the end of that show is totally bonkers, where the court case is almost funny. Like, and that's just, like, such a weird thing it does, is where it has to, like, be a joke, because it does it, like, if it were serious about it, like Shane is, then you'd have a completely different show on your hands.
It has this really weird tonal ending of, like, where it feels like it thinks itself is happy and successful in some way, but also, like, you just can't square what's actually happening with, like, the tone or the vibe of that thing. It's really odd. But yeah, I guess that goes back to, like, right, when you, right, these things, like, actively questioning violence, like, they end up kind of weird in their own ways.
Yeah, and I mean, Shane ends with, I mean, it ends with Shane blowing away a bunch of guys, like I've said, but the last one is a guy who almost gets the drop on Shane and requires Joey, who's, like, snuck in to, like, watch from a vantage point where he can see things. Again, this is, like, a child who is now watching people get shot and killed in front of him. calls to Shane like that the guy is there, and Shane manages to save himself despite getting shot himself. And it's like that plus the last scene where Shane says, Joey, there's no living with a killing. There's no going back from it, right or wrong. It's a brand that sticks. And the regret in that is just like so profound. This is getting sort of sad. Do you want to hear my favorite story about the making of this movie and perhaps one of my 10 favorite stories about the making of any movie?
Well, I found a docile topic, but yes.
Okay, so I should write this down. But there's this this story about how they're shooting the last scene. And again, like, I really do think this last scene is really great and like just such a wonderful culmination. And they're shooting it, and it's just like a one-on-one Alan Ladd and Brandon DeWilde thing. And every time Alan Ladd goes into this like extremely moving piece of dialogue, Brandon DeWilde just starts cutting up. Again, this is a kid. Starts like crossing his eyes and like making goofy faces at Ladd to see if he'll laugh. And eventually Ladd goes over to Brandon DeWilde's dad, who is on the set, and he's like, look, tell your kid to get the next take right, or I'm going to hit him. And so Brandon DeWilde manages to do the take right with some advice from his father and does not get punched by Alan Ladd, who in his defense is only about 2 feet taller than Brandon DeWilde anyway. Like, this is one of the things I love about this is that Alan Ladd is 5'6". Like, this is a short dude. Love that about it. Anyway, that's my one of my favorite story about the making of this movie. One of the great behind the scenes things. And like, my wife hates this movie, just absolutely cannot stand it. And she can't stand it because Brandon DeWilde really might be one of the most annoying child actors. Like, Joey in this is truly an insufferable little maggot. There are very few child performances more annoying than this sort of mewling, whiny kid who's decided that Alan Ladd is Christ, which it's very strange. Like, I'm sort of backing myself into a corner here. This really is a good movie, and it gets better when Joey's not around all the time. I think that's fair to say. All right, anything else you want to add, throw in there about Shane? Anything else that we need to say about that?
I don't think so. I don't really have anything. I think when one of the enduring scenes is of the child just kind of like whine yelling for Shane, that seems like a good summation of what that performance is like, and I understand if someone can't do that.
Yeah, it was rough. We've talked about two Brandon DeWilde performances on this pod before that I much prefer to his work in Shane, even if that's the thing that's probably was first in his obituary. So the theme for this week is Hold Back the Darkness, which is basically what Shane is all about, for reasons that I think we've gotten into pretty thoroughly at this point. It's a movie pretty emphatically about what it means to be the only person in a situation who can keep the darkness from just completely overwhelming the world they live in. And not necessarily successfully all the time, but this idea that there has to be someone, whether it's a gunslinger from out of town who rides in on his horse, or some other very different, perhaps much meeker kind of person. This is a story that you see over and over again in movies, and it makes for good dramas. It makes for great character studies. And we have two that are separated by just 5 years from one another, but which I think are just like totally different. The first one we're going to do is Maria Full of Grace, which is from 2004 and directed by Joshua Marston. I promised in, I think, the literal first episode, so not the first episode where we talked about movies and music, but the first episode where we like talked about what the podcast was, that I would include American movies and languages outside English. This is one of them. So this is a film which is primarily in Spanish, though not exclusively. Maria Full of Grace is primarily the star vehicle for Catalina Sandino Moreno, who is absolutely tremendous in this movie. She's playing this Colombian teenager who is working at a, I mean, I hate to call it a factory, but it's like a factory kind of setting, cutting roses, basically getting the thorns off of roses, and then the roses get bunched together and shipped out, presumably to the States, which is a really interesting way to start the movie. It happens in the first like 10 minutes that you see that, and you just sort of get the sense of like, oh, that's where the roses come from. They come from Colombia and they're being put together by teenage girls. It's a fairly stable job, but Maria is a person who doesn't want to be like her sister, basically. Her sister still lives at home. Her sister got pregnant too early and with the wrong guy, and now she's stuck with a baby and not a lot of support for that baby. So everyone at Maria's has to sort of pitch in for it. And as much as Maria is horrified by the idea of getting stuck in a life like that, she finds herself really like right on the verge of getting stuck in a life like that because she gets pregnant by her boyfriend, who she doesn't have any real interest in and who doesn't have any interest in her. Even so, he does the right thing by the mores of the time and place and asks her to marry him. And she says no. She gets sick at work because she's pregnant and like throws up on some roses and has a fight with her boss and quits the job. So like her pregnancy has sort of put her in this awkward position. And what Maria does next is she, through this, you know, more fun, more engaging guy she's met, decides that she's going to get into being a drug mule, which seems like kind of an escalation from the rose job. But it really does sort of seem, and like I wouldn't have picked this if I thought this were an exploitative kind of movie. It really does a nice job, I think, of being honest and kind of genuine about, if not like a perfect facsimile of what semi-rural Colombia looks like. At least I think it's honest about the kind of people who are there, that there are a bunch of have-nots who are basically just trying to make ends meet and desperately trying to work in whatever job will get them their daily bread, essentially. And there's a group of people who no one screws with. Everyone knows they exist, but no one wants to mess with them, who are involved in a shady but lucrative drug trade. The first scene in there, which I think gets from like kind of uncomfortable to actively like squirmy, is when you start watching Maria prepare to swallow the pellets. That's what the subtitles call it. It's very clear that the subtitles, or I'm sorry, not the subtitles, I'm thinking about those. That's what I get for calling the podcast this with you. But the pellets themselves, the pellets are like huge. Like, just think about the biggest pill you've ever swallowed after your wisdom teeth or whatever else. And it's not even close to that. Like, it's these huge things which are filled with drugs. If they burst inside your stomach, then you die. Like, that's basically it. So you're carrying like 50 or 70, depending on how big you are. Some incredible number of these things that you have to like dry swallow into your stomach, and keep there over the course of a flight to the United States, where people will pick you up and then you'll poop them out and then they will collect them, give you your money and put you back on a plane. And watching her go through the process of like figuring out how to swallow this stuff and getting to the moment where she has to audition it, basically, for the head honcho, for the chief of the drug operation. You're sort of like hoping like, please, Maria, figure it out, you know, go do it, like, good luck. But also you're hoping like, please just throw it up, dude, like, don't swallow it. There's no good way this can end for you. And that, of course, is just like some true body horror stuff in an extremely realist environment. This one is technically an HBO movie, and I was scared about using it because I was afraid it was just TV, but Sandino Moreno was nominated for an Oscar, so I figured that was good enough to call it theatrical. So have you seen this one on HBO, or is this like a new one to you?
I didn't realize it was on HBO, but that's exciting now that I know that. So no, I haven't. I've heard you talk about it before. You've mentioned it to me, but I've never seen it. I don't know. I'm trying to find a way to say this that doesn't sound weird. But like, I'm interested in body horror stuff that is real, mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
Like, I believe in the power of body horror in general, but like when it's like, when you can feel it like that, like that's really powerful to me. I have a technical question though.
Yeah.
Is there like some technique to not have them burst in your stomach?
I don't think so. Like they tell them like you can't eat anything. You've got to like completely empty yourself out. And that, obviously that makes sense. I mean, there's another scene on the plane, where she like it hurts, like it doesn't feel good in your stomach to do that, and she just like kind of poops one out in the airplane toilet and is like, well, I can't leave it here and I can't get rid of it, and so she has to go ahead and swallow that thing again while she's just sort of back there. And like, that's another body horror thing, like that it's something that, I mean, it must be, I'm not an expert in like how to transport drugs across international lines or anything, but like, I assume that they didn't like just make up this process. It seems like that's the basic principle from everything I've ever read about it in the news. And it's obviously like not as disgusting as you think. Like it's like, she doesn't have anything in her. It's just a question of like rinsing it off and like hoping for the best. But like, still, it's just like, it's a really gross moment, which is being emphasized by the filmmaking itself. Like the plane is like super blue on the inside, like the lighting is like unnaturally blue and strange. There's the fact that all the women who are taking the drugs up are like dressed nicer than like everyone else on the plane. Like they're trying not to look like bums or anything so they won't get like pulled over or caught or something. So here she is in this, you know, this nice suit, you know, like this nice appropriate suit, and, you know, swallowing a pellet of drugs in the bathroom because that's her job. I mean, it is a freaky 15 to 20 minutes where all of this stuff happens. Like it starts with us getting sort of, the cut of Maria's jib, basically, where you sort of get to see that she is this adventurous kind of person. She is responsible. She is concerned about her family. Like she's not like an airhead or anything. But she's more of a dreamer than, for example, a friend who comes up with her, her friend Blanca, who comes up to America with her, like gets herself involved in the drug trade without telling Maria that she was doing it. Like she's a decent person. She has good inclinations. She makes friends with a person who has some experience doing the drug trade, drug mule stuff, and really starts to go out of her way for her once she gets sick on the plane. Becomes clear that one of the pellets has like popped in her stomach. And one of the things that just sort of really gets me about this movie is just like, there is this extremely fine line between I have to protect myself and I have to do things that will keep me from getting into the most severe legal trouble that a 17 year old like girl from South America trying to fly into New Jersey can possibly get into. Like that's like one side of what she has to deal with. And then on the other side of it, though, is this like sense of I still have obligations to other people. which require me to act as decently as I know how, even if that does cost me something, even if that does mean that I might get in trouble or that I will lose something that I want. And that's where, like, to me, that's where, like, the hold back the darkness aspect of this film comes in. Because in the second half, after she gets pulled, and there's this, like, really, really tense scene where she gets pulled because they don't believe that this girl who cut flowers saved up to buy herself a ticket to America, especially because she, like, can't really tell them how much it cost or, like, tell them where she's going. Like, she doesn't really have good answers for those things. And she only is saved from an x-ray, which would reveal all these pellets, by the fact that she's pregnant. And again, like, how dangerous is it to be a couple months, few months pregnant and, like, be carrying all of these drugs in your system? Like, that on its own is, like, this incredible act of, like, foolhardy bravery, call it what you want. But that's, like, the basic struggle of the second half of the movie, because this woman she meets, who is a few years older than her and has some of the same tendencies, the same kind of wandering spirit, I guess we'll call it, like, something wanting something more than what's at home staring at her in the face. She dies. Maria doesn't see her body get taken away. She just knows there is a lot of blood, which suggests that she either died in a really horrible way or she died in a just no adverb horrible way, and then her body was cut open to retrieve the pellets inside of her. And she and Blanca run because Maria is now afraid that she'll get killed too. But then she spends a lot of the rest of the movie trying to do right by this woman she's met. Someone she really doesn't have any serious relationship with, but she spends a lot of time saying things like, we have to eventually get this news to her sister who lives in New York, or we have to manage to get her body back, even though that's going to be an incredibly expensive thing to do, to ship this body to Colombia. Like, this is a person who is really moral and really ethical down deep, but is in a situation where she has no English at all. Like, there is absolutely no English that she speaks. She has no understanding of what New York City is like, let alone what New Jersey is like, which is where she spends a lot of the time. She doesn't have any money to speak of because she hasn't, like, gotten it from the guys who were, like, watching them in the hotel. Like, this is someone who has no power, but is just sort of, like, feebly doing everything she can to protect herself, to protect Blanca, who is sort of a pain in her butt, and to do the right thing by this woman, again, who she really doesn't know, but who has died doing something which Maria only just realized she had it in her to do. And we can talk more about everything that goes into that, but that's, like, the basic crux of this movie, is someone who it would be just so incredibly easy for her to just kind of, like, lay down and die, or just, like, give in and throw her lot in with the worst kind of people. But despite not having anything, and despite not having any ways to get anything or to gain any security, she continues to try to do the right thing over and over again.
How does it feel to have a Jersey movie?
You know, it's a movie that I kind of had forgotten was a Jersey movie, because, like, the joke is at first that they're not even going to New York, but that they're going to New Jersey because the hotel itself is in New Jersey. So, like, there's this kind of bit about, like, oh, we're going to go to New York, going to New Jersey. And there's something very spot on and perfect about that that I do like.
That was sort of the trick of Ellis Island anyway. So I like that as a continuing.
Preach.
Yeah, like, you know, fitting all of what you were saying into the idea of the American dream anyway, that they end up in Jersey is perfect.
So at the end of the film, there's, like, this moment of reckoning, basically, where we don't have to get into how Maria has done the right thing, but like suffice it to say that she's done the right thing and that it's cost her in multiple ways. And at the end of the movie, she is supposed to be getting back on her flight to go home to Colombia after all of this. Again, for all of the harrowing experience that she's had without that much extra money in her pocket. But she basically decides to stick around, which is sort of fun because it's the opposite of what Shane does. There really is kind of a mirror Shane universe here where Shane leaves because he feels like he can't fit into the moral fabric of the community anymore. She stays because she can't see herself fitting into the moral fabric of her old community anymore. And it's interesting because this very easily, I think, could have been some like enormous movie, some supersized movie where the first half is the story of what she does when she's in New York and the sort of deception she has to go through and the deception she has to commit in order to stay safe or to stay reasonably safe there. And then there would be a second half where she like tries to adjust to America as someone with no identity, no papers, no leads, no money, no home, nothing. But that same person, the same person who was brave enough to, you know, fight off all of the insecurities that come with being someone who has no relevant experience to America, it continues on. Like, she continues to sort of push for herself and push for what she thinks is better and push for this like new identity, new personhood that she couldn't have seen in herself 3 or 4 weeks earlier, but which she has discovered she has in herself now.
I'm so like, do you see this as a triumphant movie in some way? Like, I'm kind of balancing that against Shane, which
I think it's much the same kind of measured triumph, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like the perception of Shane is that it's triumphant, but really it's like more like there's much more angst there than maybe is the like the pull away. But the, I mean, just the way you're describing the end of this, like, right, it's limited because it's just one person, obviously, but like, and it's harrowing, but like, I don't know. Does it come away with like a look at the possibility of someone in dire straits?
I don't think it looks at it as a possibility thing. I think it looks at it more like Maria has been making, frankly, life or death choices for the extent of the movie. What's one more? It's not an offhand kind of thing. I know I just made it sound kind of offhand, but like, this is a film which ends with this. It's more bittersweet. I think Shane is sadder. I think angst is a good word, like you said, for that one. But this one is much more bittersweet. There's a lot more hope. But I mean, I think that hope is almost more because of the other movies we've seen. Like, we sort of have hope for this plot where someone comes to America and in dire straits and makes good, more than it is actually a film which substantiates that with anything which has been happening to her. Like, she's already gotten through by the skin of her teeth. How many more lives does this particular cat have, I think, is sort of the question you should, not you, but like that the viewer should be asking oneself at the end of this. Full pronoun work. I love doing pronouns.
There you go. No, that makes sense. That's sort of like, you kind of got to it near the end there. Like, I was wondering how to balance that with the, you know, the myth of success, or just the, right, you can come here and succeed, you know, just take some hard work and elbow grease. But the measuredness of it that you were mentioning, that makes sense.
Yeah. Something I like about this director, something good about the movie, and I'll connect this to another one in a second, but Marston does a nice job, I think, of showing that there is a support system. So like, a lot of the stuff that Maria does is facilitated in large part by someone who is kind of a community organizer who has contacts and who has some legal knowledge and who people can just sort of talk to. And like, I think it'd be easy for the film to just make this person kind of a deus ex machina kind of figure and just like use them to solve everything. But I also just kind of think that he's useful. Like the character is useful, but he's also someone who has extremely limited power and at the same time has more power and more understanding of the situation than Maria herself does. Like he feels like a very realistic person. Like there is someone who is friendly to undocumented people, someone who is friendly to people who are literally on the run from employees of drug lords. Like there's definitely something very realistic about the fact that you can get help, but that the help you get is very much about what you can do yourself. Like someone can tell you basically what they think or like legally what options you have, but like he can't actually make any of that stuff happen for her, which I think is interesting. He's got another movie, which is an Albanian movie. So I don't think I can count this as an American. I know he's so interesting. He like just goes places and like films these extremely, extremely authentic pictures about these like insular kind of communities. But there's an Albanian movie that he directed called The Forgiveness of Blood, which has a similar kind of vibe to it. The same kind of feeling of there is a legal recourse, but there are limits to what the power of that can be. And like, the teenager who sort of understands that, but doesn't quite comprehend all of what that means there. It's just a really, really interesting like window of coming of age movies that Marston does once every 6 or 7 years. Like he's not like the most prolific guy. But it's interesting that there is like this type of coming of age movie that only he seems to be doing, stuff which could be a lot more cheerful, like you were hinting at, but which, I mean, in practice tends to be much more sobering than that. Anything else about Maria?
Where is Marston from?
That's a great question. Let's look this up real quick.
I was just going to say, too, the only other movie I've ever heard even invoke Albania is Inside Man, which is a phenomenal movie. So maybe Albania is the secret sauce here.
Yeah. Marston's from Los Angeles.
That's too boring. I was really hoping somewhere else, but whatever.
I think it's kind of funny, actually. Like he's one of the he's got to be one of the only people in the entire world who are actually from Los Angeles. Like no one's from Los Angeles. He's actually from Los Angeles.
That's a fair point.
All right. So that's Maria Full of Grace again. That one is super, super easy to access. It is an HBO movie. It'll be on HBO and HBO Max until the end of time, presumably. So like that's a nice thing to be able to go back to. A movie that is maybe a little bit more famous, but a little bit harder to track down day in, day out, is Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead from 1999, which we could, if we wanted to be a little bit pejorative, just refer to as Ambulance Driver, because Nicolas Cage is Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver, except with an ambulance instead of a taxi. It is Martin Scorsese. It is Paul Schrader. They've gotten the band back together for that. It's grimy, grubby New York. It's got a similar, it's a very different color palette, but the same emphases are in there in terms of cinematography. There is a girl who the Nicolas Cage character wishes he could have protected better, who is already dead. So not like Jodie Foster, but someone who has been dead. There is this sort of unobtainable woman who is sort of more decent than the protagonist, in this case played by Patricia Arquette, and not by Cybill Shepherd. Like, look, I understand that this movie is riffing so hard on Taxi Driver that it's almost not its own movie. But on the other hand, people talk about 1999 as this brilliant movie year all the time, and like no one ever says it's because of Bringing Out the Dead, which I think is a top 10 Scorsese movie. But like this is a masterpiece. This is an absolutely remarkable movie, which I don't think people have seen. I think people just sort of shrug it off or haven't heard of it. I'd be curious to know what you know about this one going in.
I'm pretty sure it has a top five REM song in it.
Oh my
which
God.
Is going to be my take for the episode.
Okay, so that needle drop for What's the Frequency, Kenneth, is unbelievable. It is so good. It is the second best Scorsese needle drop that I can think of. There is Layla in Goodfellas, and then there's this. This is just an absolutely incredible piece of combining music with something that doesn't necessarily go with it. It just makes sense on this kind of cellular, molecular level. It's a scene which is like this very, very antic, very, very rapid movement of the ambulance. While What's the Frequency, Kenneth, is happening, a song which famously, you could tell me the lyrics predicted, I don't know, like the Y2K bug, or you could tell me that the lyrics were about Pope Urban's speech that began the First Crusade. You could tell me they were about anything, and I would believe you. Do you want to try to tell me what they're about? I'll believe you no matter what you tell me.
I mean, I can tell you the incident that I think inspired it in some degree,
okay,
which is someone, either they assaulted or attempted to assault Dan Rather.
What? Okay, you're finding the limits of my belief.
See, I'm good. Let me look it up, but I'm like, I think that's true. I don't know. I don't think it's a song about that incident, but in some way, like, maybe it's just the title, because like I think the title was something that like that dude was saying. I don't, like, it has some connection to that. I'll look it
That's
up. That's
unbelievable. That's like just absolutely unbelievable stuff. That makes the usage of it that much better.
I will say too, if people want to hear more about What's the Frequency, Kenneth, we talked Monster back in like episode 4 or something. So go back there. But yeah, I will investigate this if you want to keep riffing.
All right. So Bringing Out the Dead, is about the Nick Cage character, Frank Pierce. Frank Pierce is a paramedic. He's having this crisis of confidence, essentially, in which he hasn't actually saved anyone in a while. And he's starting to wonder if this is really the job for him. He's starting to become more and more disillusioned about where he's driving and like the New York that he's seeing. And it's easy to see why. The hospital that he's like based out of that we keep seeing him take people to is just like, it's like a Civil War hospital after the Battle of Gettysburg. Like there's just bodies on stretchers and gurneys everywhere. It's disgusting. It's gross. It smells bad. It's just like an absolute fever dream of nastiness. And that's the hospital. that's not even the rest of like New York City hanging around. So it takes place over a few nights. It begins with Frank trying to rescue this one guy whose last name is Burke, tries to save Burke, who is this older man whose daughter Mary is played by Patricia Arquette. So that's where she comes in. And Frank and his first partner, we see him with three partners. I guess the ghost of Christmas past in this case is Larry, played by John Goodman. So Nick Cage and John Goodman are paramedics trying to save this guy, trying to bring him back with music and CPR. And basically Frank manages to get this guy to regain, you know, like a heartbeat essentially, but he's a vegetable. So they take him to the hospital and he's like over the course of the movie, that's going to be like the through line, is this guy who is in the hospital, sort of doggedly hanging on to life because his body just won't give up, essentially. Like, he's kind of in that position. Then the next person Frank is with, this is the funny part, I guess. Marcus is one of Frank's partners. Marcus is driving around. Marcus is played by Ving Rhames. Marcus is flirting with the dispatcher, who is voiced by Queen Latifah in this particular section, which is funny, but not as funny as if or as it would have been if Martin Scorsese were still voicing the dispatcher, which he does in a different part of the movie. But Ving Rhames is like this kind of religious figure. He and Frank managed to bring back somebody in a club who goes by I.B. Bannon. Like, that's the name that the friends give. So there's this absolutely ludicrous scene where it's like this goth club in New York City somewhere, and Nick Cage and Ving Rhames show up, and like Nick Cage is like giving the guy Narcan to try to like restart his heart from this overdose, as meanwhile Ving Rhames is leading this impromptu tent revival and saying things like, "Lord, bring back I.B. Bannon," like, and it's just like this absolutely ridiculous sequence. And it's not even the weirdest thing that happens with Ving Rhames in this movie. Like, it's not even close. And then the ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, the most threatening ghost, is played by Tom Sizemore, who is like kind of Frank's frenemy. Tom is like this kind of like evil paramedic, evil ambulance driver. It's like the opposite, where Frank is kind of numb to everything. Can't sleep, can't eat, only works, feels sick, can't even get fired. Like, he can't even get his boss to fire him for showing up late all the time. Tom is like manic and always trying to like beat the clock or beat someone up. He's got this vendetta against a homeless guy played by Mark Anthony. And like over and over again, even if the people are a little different, or even if the settings are a little bit different, the film comes back to Frank trying to hold back the darkness in one of a few ways. He is trying to hold back the darkness and trying to keep Mr. Burke alive, which is one way to try to, you know, push away the badness, which is sort of inherent in his setting. There is this sort of running thing where he can't save anyone. Marcus will save someone, or Tom will be able to do it, or I'll hear that someone else has, but like Frank personally cannot bring someone back to a state of health. That's sort of in there. There's Mary, who Nick Cage's character starts to take a liking to, and she relapses into her drug habit during the midst of this, and he's like trying to keep up with her, and that's not all the way successful. And then there's Mark Anthony, who like really is in here as a very charismatic, vaguely crazy, unhoused guy named Noel, who used to live in the neighborhood where the Burks live, essentially. And Noel is like just in this constant state of being tied to gurneys, or like being beaten up, or blowing out the windshields on cars. Like, just a true mess of a human being who no one is really taking care of, and Frank is like trying to do things to be helpful to him, even if it seems totally impotent, because every night he's bringing in Noel. Like, every night there is like a new thing with Noel, where Noel is doing something crazy, or Noel is trapped, or Noel is freaking out, or something like that. It is a very cyclical movie. It's a movie that really does play into this, like, the first night, here are the things. Second night, here are the things. Third night, here are the things. And, like, over and over again, you can't help but feel like if you had to do this, you would be much crazier than Nicolas Cage in this movie. You might even be much crazier than Nicolas Cage in like Zombily, for whatever that's worth. So like, it is a film where there is only one guy who feels like he's even trying to do the right thing to protect other people, and he feels like he is an abject failure because that's the report the world is giving him, because every time he tries to do anything, it just doesn't seem to work.
Do you want a song facts?
Mm-hmm.
So I've investigated, I suppose, as widely as I can in the like few minutes. Rolling Stone has an article about the genesis of the song, and it was in New York City. Someone attacked Dan Rather and was asking Kenneth, "What's the frequency?" It took maybe almost 10 years, I think, for them to figure out who did it. He finally stepped forward and admitted to it. Paranoid schizophrenic, and so that much seems like utterly verifiable. And apparently Dan Rather also went on stage to perform with REM at one point. Other bits of this that I don't have, I suppose take them with a grain of salt, but I think they hold up. The song is about a boomer trying to understand Gen X via media consumption, which kind of tracks if you go look at the lyrics. And Michael Stipe potentially in an interview saying he was intrigued by the case because it's the premier unsolved American surrealist act of the 20th century. I love that phrase.
Interesting. It's interesting he chose that. It's interesting that he thinks that's the one.
So there you have it. That's the that's actually what's the frequency Kenneth is about, and I'm glad that truth was indeed stranger than fiction there for you.
Yeah, it absolutely was. Anything about the plot that we need to get through for this? I can definitely specify more on like favorite threads to go into here, in terms of Frank Pierce's basic impotence in trying to protect the people around him. But is there one that you'd like to follow, or do you have other thoughts?
No, I go wherever compels you, I suppose. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so something that I like about this is that it gets into the sort of dreamscape a little bit more often than Taxi Driver does. Like Taxi Driver uses that Bernard Herrmann score that we talked about a little bit to sort of set this tone, to set this mood. And then at the end of the film, people have frequently tried to question like how much of that gory encounter, speaking of a gunslinger coming to town, how much of Travis Bickle's rampage is real versus fantasized. Obviously the paramedic does not go on a kill spree in this one. I think it's interesting though that Schrader is still writing up things that are obviously like not really happening, much more so than he does in Taxi Driver. It's not fantasy so much as it is like drug trips or just like dream sequences outright. So there's one where Frank like is dreaming about this girl that he couldn't save, like this one person who's like particularly on his mind as the person who's started his bad streak and who he feels like personally very guilty about. And as he's thinking about her, like there's this dream where he starts seeing all of these other people sort of like rising up from the pavement who he also couldn't save, and like there's this huge number of them. And it gets into this idea which feels again, it feels very much in line with Shane of like, my job is to do this. I'm good at doing this. Like, my job is to be the good paramedic. And much the same way that Shane's talents lead him to being a gunfighter. But I sort of have to look at all the dead bodies in my wake and like figure out, is this right for me to be doing? Like, as much as Shane must have gotten some kind of monetary satisfaction out of it, or as much as Frank is tied to it, because like he could just bail on this, but he like is too ethical to actually do that, slash too stuck to actually do that. He still has to face down all of these people who he's failed, and like looking at, is it the same for me to have not saved these people? Is that a me responsibility? Is it just that it's their time to go? Is there some kind of fate that like projects when people go or when people don't go? Am I just so terrible at this? And am I letting down this entire community by being like totally incompetent? And a lot of that is being done in like Frank freaking out in front of other people. It is 90s Nick Cage. You get some pretty decent freakouts here and there. But it's also very much an introspective thing here that I do like a lot. It gives a voice, it gives image to these doubts that Frank is having that are much more specific and much more frightening and much more personal than just like, oh, it's so hard to be a paramedic. I can't save everyone. Things are bad. It's like, no, he not only can't save everyone, but he actively sees faces of people who he couldn't bring back or people he didn't reach in time or whatever. And that just feels like such a profound and terrible thing to have to look at day in, day out, or more accurately, night in, night out, because this is not a daytime movie. The scenes in daylight are extremely few and far between.
That's something we see, I don't know about a lot, but at least some amount of, like, in hospital settings. Like, I suppose the lingering grief or guilt, like, that has on usually doctors. Like, we see that played out sometime. It's interesting to have it as, you know, what about these, you know, what about a responder like this? You know, what about these other areas where, I don't know, it doesn't seem like anyone's suggesting the ambulance driver is a hero here. But they, you know, they have to deal with that darkness all the same. And you know, maybe more, I'm not trying to weigh their like relative workloads here, but like, right, if you're an ambulance driver or worker, you're inherently responding to crisis constantly. Like, there's no break from that. That's just interesting to me to take that, like, you know, what are all the other areas that are, or the other, I suppose, types of people that are holding back the darkness and not just the kind of the typical ones we go to.
Which is, I think that's actually kind of an interesting point for this movie, because it's clear that Mary has tried with Noel before. Like, Noel like kind of lived with them for a while. But at some point it ran out. The time ran out, and now Noel's on the street, and like Mary sees him now and then, and just like that's a guy who got through the net. That's somebody who got trapped by the darkness and couldn't be brought back. And like, Mary is threatening throughout the film to be that kind of person who is trapped in the darkness and who they can't bring back out, because she's like getting back into drugs, and like there's some like violence having to do with that. That's kind of climactic, but we don't have to get into that because that doesn't feel super thematic to me. It's just like, you could not blame the ambulance driver. Like, the ambulance driver is not a random person to focus on in this kind of movie, but the ambulance driver is someone who you could pick out of this group and it feels fair. But the movie could just have easily been about Mary and her family not being able to keep Noel. Or it could have just been about Noel being on the streets and being in jeopardy all the time and being brought in. Or the drunk guy who always gets the ambulance called for him and the ambulance guys all know him. They're like, he stinks up the ambulance. We do not want to take him. I mean, it could be about any number of people, but the idea that all of them are like trying to hold up their little patch of wallpaper and like the wallpaper is still like tapping them on the head and falling on them anyway. It's like an entire community where that's happening. And Frank just happens to be one of the more interesting and legible people you can actually run that idea through. All right. We ready for Spiel?
Yeah. I don't think I have anything else. I was pondering one thought, but I don't, it's very like quarter formed. So I'm going to hold off on that. I think I'm ready for Spiel though.
All right. Let's talk through it. So the initial film for this week is Shane, from 1953 by George Stevens, a Western, which I think is just one of the quintessential kind of like texts that you have to go back to if you're going to do a study of Westerns or a consideration of Westerns in this country. And the reason is that it's got the gunfighter come into town, the lone gunfighter, moseying on in and facing up to his past and dealing with his traumas. It's very psychological in that way. And that theme of hold back the darkness of who is the person in the given situation who is going to take the most responsibility to try to do what's right. The person who's going to give the most of themselves to try to push against that encroaching failure or that encroaching tragedy, or pick your ugly noun as you will, but like that's the basic premise. And in Maria Full of Grace from 2004, directed by Joshua Marston, a movie about a young woman from Colombia who winds up in the United States longer than she meant to be, who winds up in New Jersey and New York trying desperately to do the right thing for her, try to do things that will get her the money that she needs to support her sister. And her sister's sick infant, but also try to get money to support herself as she's pregnant, trying to support her friend who is fearful and wayward as they're stuck in New York, trying to support a young woman who she knew for a very limited time who dies tragically. Someone who has just thrown all of these frightening responsibilities that even your best 17-year-olds aren't going to be able to weather all that well. It's something that your 37 or 47-year-olds couldn't necessarily weather all that well. And at the same time, trying to, you know, be decent enough so that she can still hold her head up as she like has to look back at the things that she's done to keep herself and her friend safe as she can get them safe. And then on the other hand, we have Bringing Out the Dead, one of the, I'm going to call it an underseen Scorsese, because I sure as heck don't think this is a lesser one. This is an underseen Scorsese from the 90s when people complained about him for reasons passing understanding. But a picture about an ambulance driver, a paramedic, who sees himself as this one stitch in a tearing fabric of Manhattan, someone who is night to night kind of living this waking nightmare, and even his nightmares are nightmarish, just this constant anxiety of crisis, this constant anxiety of I'm the person on the front lines who has to fix things. What can I do to make it better? And just always feeling like he can't quite fix the problem, who was always just a little inadequate. And it's not helped because it seems like people who aren't any better than him seem to be able to save a life here and there. And yet he is someone who tries to save lives. And at the end of the movie, it turns out that the thing he's best at doing is taking life to relieve someone else's pain, as opposed to relieving pain by helping them get better. So those are our two in what has turned into an extraordinarily cheerful episode as the sun sets and the room darkens around me. What do you think?
Good somber episode or ending anyway here. After the joys of discussing the technicalities of drug muling and REM's enduring greatness.
I was about to say, if I had a real ear for segues, I would have just looked at you and said, well, what's the frequency, Kenneth?
I'm ashamed of you.
Yeah.
I put myself on the spot, too. I have to think of what my other top REM songs are, but that's a different half of this podcast. I like this theme because I'm an abiding cynic, or I don't know, depressive, I suppose. So like, I don't know, anything that's like wrestling with this idea of holding back the darkness honestly has my attention. And all of these movies seem to be doing that. I'm going to go with, Maria Full of Grace though. And I don't have my thumb exactly on like what separates the two for me. Like it's just this one's sort of instinctual. Like that one just kind of worked better for me. I think part of it is because, you know, certainly they're all doing this, but like Shane has that like top layer of it's going to question the very thing that the person has to do to survive and to like make things better. It seems to me more explicitly anyway that Maria Full of Grace is kind of prompting that in the audience, like to question the ethicality, or what we presume to be ethical, because what would we do in a situation where like we just want to help our family or our child or, you know, whomever it is, like, right, what do you have to do to actually make that work? So balancing those layers, and also right when you were mentioning like there are some people or some structures in place that like, you know, we can give you information or kind of help you or like legal advice or stuff like that, you know, with immigration in particular, you know, I kind of just see that too as like a holding back the darkness. Like it's something we do because it's good and we should, but like how much is it really going to hold back? Like you know, I like the wallpaper analogy, like that seems to be threaded through all of these of like, we're just doing our best to hold it up for as long as we can.
Yeah, that's something interesting that I think all three of these are getting into and which I could have talked about more in Shane, but maybe I should have. But this idea that the community has some culpability to hold back the darkness and the fact that it requires a Shane, a Maria, a Frank to do it is a sign that the community has sort of failed in some way, or that the community is insufficient to meet its own needs in some way, and that it requires this drastic action or this really special action. I liked Maria Full of Grace for this too. I've been trying to, like I've said before, I've been trying to keep 2000s movies out of here as best I could. But I just thought that this one was such a good fit for this particular idea that I couldn't, or I didn't have the heart to save it for another season. So I'm glad that it's gone through here. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this particular episode, go back and listen to part one of this where Matt discussed The Carter Three, in which the lyrics a milli explain more or less what Maria goes to the United States to find. If you are interested in finding Matt's playlist, if you're interested in finding my Letterboxd, if you're interested in listening to back episodes of this, if you're interested in our backgrounds, because we are, you know, sort of an 8-part limited series in our own right, you can find all of that good stuff at subtitlespodcast.com, and we'll see you next time.